Hello.
Hello, sir.
How are you doing this fine morning?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Not too bad. It's not quite as warm as it has been yet, 'cause we've got some rain overnight, cooled
That's
things down.
good then.
Yeah, as I was doing a lot of sweating yesterday.
Yeah, I bet. We outside a lot.
Yeah, let's start off the day. Cut the grass for the first time in a long time because we finally have gotten enough rain for it to grow
Right.
and ran the trimmer and did a few other things outside. Even though it was the morning, by the time I was done, I was drenched because I sweat a lot.
Yeah.
And then the afternoon, I cleaned the house and I got a little sweaty again.
Do you have air conditioning or no?
We just have a couple window units
You
upstairs,
don't have central air.
but we don't have central now.
Yeah, it's one of the best things that I ever bought, but I get hot easy, so
Yeah, I do too.
especially at night, like that's when I'd have trouble sleeping because it has to be like a certain temperature.
Yeah. My wife and I are pretty much the op on the opposite of that kind of thing.
I mean, we are too.
Yeah.
Barb gets cold, I don't.
I tell you, man.
So.
Women need to warm up.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I have the leverage of, and you might have this too, but I have the leverage of having a dog.
Yeah.
And dogs,
Are warm.
she's with me, so we get to do the AC at night to keep the dog cool, and I get to benefit from that. I said,
Yeah.
"Well, I think it's going to be too warm tonight for Mabel, so we better use the AC tonight." And
Yeah.
then her and the cat like it warm.
That's cool.
So,
Now we have
yeah.
gophers now in our
Gophers.
backyard, and they're making these huge mounds at night in our yard. So we got like a gopher repellent, which just shoots out a sound every so often. But in the bold letters it says, well, during the first week or so, you might see more increased activity as they're before it starts to chase them away, and they realize it's consistent. So there are like three more mounds in our yard today. It's
Oh, geez. What kind of sound repels gophers?
a gopher squeal, like a anxiety thing. Like it sounds like it replicates their like danger kind of sound that they would make.
Let me find that was the same way if they made a person
Mating call.
repellent.
We got the wrong
Yeah,
version.
drawn
It was
it.
a mating call.
Yeah. It's like, this sounds like gophers fucking. Why is this? How's
Yeah,
this
let's
supposed to
go. There's
work?
a gopher orgy over here. Let's come on. Let's bring it on.
Gopher orgy
But we
in
didn't want to get
my
something that
backyard.
would like kill them or something, you know what I mean? Like
Yeah, I
plus we
gotcha.
have a dog, so you don't want to put poison.
Right. Yeah, you don't want anything that she'd get into.
We were gonna call pest control and they put like traps and then they come and check the traps, but we didn't do that. Which reminds me, I gotta set a reminder to put the lock on the side gate. I forgot.
Maybe they'll
Set reminder for putting lock on site gate for noon. There, see? Siri will do that
Okay,
for
I'll
me.
remind you.
There, thank you, Siri. I forget. I was supposed to do that last night and I forgot. Me and Barb walked Harley again yesterday. We walked her twice. And I told her, remind me when we get back so I could put the lock back on the side gate because we had a lot of hail damage. So we had a roofer come and inspect, and they come and inspect the paint and everything, you know, the whole house. So I had
Yeah.
to open up the gate. I forgot to close it.
I wonder if I could get a people repellent that works in the same manner. Like, I just
Yeah.
put it out there, and it'll,
Some guy screaming all the time.
some guy like, I spent too much money. I don't know where my next paycheck's coming from.
Yeah. Just a Donald Trump kind of talker out there,
Oh,
just talking.
That would work on me, man. I'd go run in the opposite direction.
And me too.
Hell out of here.
Oh, God. I've never seen anything like it.
No. Well, we don't want to go down that.
No, we don't want to go down that rabbit hole.
Well, people will tune into the episode and not get what they expect.
All right. Do you want to jump right in then?
Yeah, I guess. Maybe you want to do...
Do Battlestar this time because we went comics first.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. So we're on episode 5 of Battlestar Galactica, which is kind of like a part 2, but it's an ongoing thread throughout the episode. And just to set you up where we left off last, there was a void that the Galactica had to go into. Half of the team, the fighter pilots like Boomer and I can never remember that other guy's name. I can't. Jolly, I think. Were, and a lot of other guys, Ed Begley Jr., I don't even know if he has a name. They're in like a really bad state of sickness, and they had to train their shuttle pilots, which were all females, to be fighter pilots. And they had to go back to get a cure for those guys while Adama was reading the book of Kobol, and he was finding out that this void was like a foresight into their religious groups and how all the Earth's people started. Well, at least they're not the Earth people, because the Earth people is like the 13th, whatever. I don't know what they call them. Do you remember what they call them?
Just tribe, I think.
13th tribe.
Yeah.
Is where they migrated to Earth, but he wants to go find it, and it talks about the void saving them. Meanwhile, Baltar has his ship, and he's told that he's supposed to have peace missions again with them, but how do you do that if you betrayed the entire Galactica? And he's got like an agenda that is really hard to read at this point, mm-hmm. because he's got robots that are not really, the Cylons are using him, but he seems to be using the Cylons for whatever agenda that he has, and I'm not sure what his agenda is yet. And that pretty much where we left off. There was a fight scene with the females and Starbuck and Apollo with the Cylons as they brought the cure back, and then they kind of rushed this episode and they gave the cure, which we really didn't see them like land in the last episode and get whatever they needed, but they did. Mm-hmm. And they applied it to the Boomer and everybody. They were able to even talk to Boomer, even though he was really, really, really ill still, but he was alive. So yeah. the cure worked, but that's kind of like where it left off. It kind of like jumped ahead, and then they were in the break room and they're all talking about, the women are all excited because of what they accomplished, and Apollo and Starbuck are actually talking like the women, and they're talking like starfighters, which was a little humorous.
Yeah. Apollo was talking about the where they were going to live.
Yeah.
Once they got married, and the place that he found.
Is her name Serena, or is it Serene?
Either is close enough to work for me.
Because I just call her by her actress name usually, because I don't have her down. But
Serena, I think, yeah. Sounds right. Yeah, we actually see Apollo and Starbuck talking to Boomer at the beginning of the episode. And I don't know if I don't want to jump too far ahead, but it sounds so. Apollo and Serena are supposed to be assigned together. There's some kind of dictation that they should be kept together. And now that they've, even the regular pilots are all still recovering. So they're still treating the Hot Girl Brigade. Because it still it continues to amuse me that all of the women that they brought in are all attractive actresses.
Yeah, yeah.
Jane Seymour, and it just drives that home when you see them all sitting together and talking. They're all young and pretty.
Yeah.
But, so Apollo and Serena are supposed to go out on a mission together.
But Starbucks, he doesn't even, like, it's not even, like, willing. And even Colonel Ty seems surprised. Like, I'm not aware of that memo or something like that. Because they have to go scout. They see an image, like, flashing off and on and off and on in the void. And they're supposed to go inspect it and see what it is.
Yeah.
They don't know if it's a rock or a Cylon base ship or what. They just know they have to go check it out. And Starbuck and Apollo just instinctively go start walking down the hallway. And Colonel Ty's like, this is what we got to do, blah, 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 blah. And then Serena shows up and she says, I'm Apollo's wingman, and I'm supposed to go with him, not Starbuck. And I don't know why that memo came or who it came from, because it's very weird. Because even from a military standpoint, do you want both of the parents of a child to be, you know, potentially killed? You know what I mean? On the same mission? And also you have a little bit of a conflict of interest. You know, they try to keep, like, even when husband and spouse are in the workforce, they try to keep them on separate projects, right, just in case there's kind of like a marital dispute at home or something like that. They don't want that being brought into the workplace. So it's very strange from that perspective, but this is the 70s. This is 78. So I don't know how it was perceived back then as opposed to the way it's perceived now. But they were both surprised, and Starbuck, being the guy that he is, he decides to go anyway, and he gets an Apollo ship and launches, and Apollo follows along with him, along with Serena, and there's three ships that launched, even though there was only supposed to be two.
Right.
And I like the strategy. I don't know if you like the strategy, but they're still in the void. So they're like, well, how are we going to be able to navigate back to the Galactica? And Starbuck is even realizing, well, you know, I could even get lost, because his little method of counting and that, you know, doing his stuff and be able to turn around at 180 and go straight back is starting to diminish the farther and farther they get. So yeah, they decide to this I really like. They decide to stay equidistant from each other, and so you have like Starbuck in front, Apollo next, and then Serena at the end, and she's tracking the lights from the Galactica. And they decide to go in that formation, and then they see Cylons. They're like above the Cylons, and it's almost like initially they don't even detect the Cylon ships until they're above them, and that's when they kind of like lose Starbuck. But I thought that was like amazing. Like the other thing that I find really gratifying in this episode is, to me, the special effects are pretty legit. I mean, the ships in space and stuff, and the laser fire and stuff, they don't look bad. Do you know what I mean? They still hold up.
Yeah, they don't. I didn't even really think about them, and I mean that in a good way. You know, because they weren't distracting at all. I didn't have to really put forth much suspension of disbelief to try to ignore them. But no, I thought it was interesting. I thought the plan made sense in a way that it was an extension of what Starbuck had done before. Like you said, they couldn't accomplish that in the same fashion, but it was it made sense that they would think of it, because it was sort of a extension of what he had done before. But this time they had three ships, which ironically there was only supposed to be two of them, but because they had three, that was what made them able to pull this off. So I thought that was pretty neat.
Pull it off, sort of.
Well,
because
yeah,
they do lose Starbuck. They're given orders by Baltar to not kill him, but to rein one of the fighter pilots in.
Yeah.
And they don't know really who they're bringing in, but because Starbuck's in the front, they capture Starbuck. And they bring him to the Cylon base ship.
Yeah, and even though it's only 5 episodes in, and as you said, it's really just been kind of a continual story so far. We've had a 3-parter, and then this is the second of a 2-parter, but it really just feels like one long story so far, and not that episodic. And so even though we're only that far into the series, it already felt pretty satisfying to see someone from the humans face to face with the Cylon forces. Because it's all been at a distance. It's all been in spaceships. So when Starbuck is brought before Balthazar, and there's the Lucifer guy and a couple other Cylons, it was satisfying to finally see that.
And I enjoy that Lucifer lead, as a Cylon, because
Yeah, it's
he's
interesting.
almost like the next level generation of a Cylon, which he puts a
Yeah.
lot of like human thought in his analysis. Like even when he's doing analysis on Baltar, trying to figure out why Baltar's doing what he's doing as a human.
Yeah.
Whereas the other, your standard Cylon is by your command. They're there to follow orders, not to outthink of the person who's giving them the orders.
Right.
And
Yeah, and
you see a lot of that here.
even later on, Lucifer makes a statement that he's of a similar model to the leader.
Yeah.
So I think he pretty much is of a more advanced model for sure. But we do see more of the type of thing I'm talking about
Well,
this episode too.
one thing I wanted to ask you, and I think I know the answer to this, but I wanted to make sure, and it leads into a question we got. But did you watch the new one?
No. Only, well, I think I quite a while ago,
Started it.
such that I don't really remember it. I watched what I think the first episode of that is basically a movie, I think, and
Yeah.
I think I watched that, but I don't even really remember it.
But one thing that's kind of fascinating about, comparing the two is that the religious connotations in the new one, and as opposed to like what they're believing on this Book of Kobol thing, you know what I mean? It's very different, very, very different, but you see some of that in this one because they actually are in the void. And they, while Starbuck and them, while Starbuck's being captured and Apollo and Serena are coming back to the ship, they discover a light, like a light source, and that light turns out to be a planet in the middle of this void, and that turns out to be Kobol. And that's when Adama like lands, and he's like fascinated, like he wants to go into this pyramid stripe structure and go find out what his predecessors had done or what the scriptures say
Yeah.
based on what's there. And he's like he has enough knowledge to try to read the hieroglyphics. Like he's not fluent in it, but he knows enough, whereas the other people, they don't, Apollo and Serena, they don't know what they're doing. And the other thing that was really interesting, this is what I found absolutely fascinating of this episode, is Serena's like, let's get married. You know what I mean? And that happens because of what happens on Kobol, but it makes sense. I mean, from their perspective, because they're like, we're pilots and we could die anytime we go out, and I'd rather die knowing that I have a husband or, out there than not ever letting it happen to begin with.
Right.
And that was pretty amazing in itself. But they go deep in this pyramid and they discover a lot of things. And Baltar convinces the Cylons that he wants to meet them in the planet and go down there. And they have like these little things Adama wears and Baltar wears around their neck. And what they turn out to be is like keys into this pyramid. So Baltar is actually able to meet them in the pyramid and convince them, sort of, in a very weird way, that he's on their side. At least he convinces Apollo more so than Adama. Adama's saying, "I won't trust a word you ever say,"
Yeah.
which I don't give. I don't think they can trust him. But then he
No.
mentions that he brought Starbuck with him, and it kind of changes Apollo's mind and stuff. But it was a very interest. There's some very interesting scenes in there between Baltar and Adama, that I thought were pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree. And I agree with your assessment that Adama's not going to trust Balthazar no matter what, but
Yeah.
Apollo's sort of second-guessing the situation, not really when he's just saying that he could bring Starbuck when Starbuck actually shows up, you know, but it's still kind of clear that Balthazar is pretty much out for himself. That's the only person he really cares about is himself.
Yeah, and he's got some weird agenda between the Earth people, the humans, and the Cylons, because he's like somewhere in between. Like, he has no, I don't know what his I know what his initial motive was. It was to basically, okay, get, you know, I'll side with you guys to attack the Galactica and all the other things, but you're going to grant me one of the colonies. Do you know what I mean? So he can run a colony by himself, and then they betrayed him. So he's got to have some kind of retribution on the Cylons themselves, as well as he knows that he betrayed his human humanity. So he's somewhere in the middle, and I don't know at this point in the show, I don't know where he's going to fall. Like, I don't know. I mean, the stuff he says is appealing. Like, hey, you know, we need to do this and then attack the Cylons. I don't know if that's legit at this point. You know, I wouldn't trust him personally, but
no. And he's the sort to sort of adapt to the situation and whatever's going to work for him. I think that ultimately he's willing to play both sides against each other. He just wants power, and he wants to end up in power, whether it's power over humans or power over the Cylons. He wants to just try to manipulate both sides to his own advantage, I think.
Yeah, and this also has, like, in this pyramid, it's got trap devices like you'd see in, like, Indiana Jones and stuff. So they have to be, like, very careful because they could close the doors on themselves and get trapped forever. You know, they see, like, Tomb Raiders in there before, like, dead bodies and stuff like that. But Baltar's not very smart. So, you know, he just starts running around like a madman, and he sees, like, this old sarcophagus and a tomb of one, and he, like, pulls the thing aside, and he actually brings down a lot of the pyramid on top of him and traps him in there because of his willing to try to find out what's going on. And he touches the scepter, which sets off the traps. Yeah. And then that's the time when Lucifer kind of just says invade, you know, like, I don't know that he's going to come back. I don't know that Baltar is going to come back. So go ahead and attack. And sure enough, most of their pilots, this is where it's really weird. All the Galactica is kind of like undefended right now. they had sent all their pilots with them to Kobol, and most of the pilots are the females, and they're outside, like, in tents outside the pyramids, while Serena, Apollo, and Adama are in the pyramid trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
So they attack them at, like, the right time. They just decide to attack, and they bring the pyramid down even worse. And that's when they escape the pyramid, but they leave Baltar there, like, trapped under all this debris. Like, they're not going to save him. They just leave him. And he's just, like, screaming out Lucifer's name in vain. Like, you jerk, you know, like, I'm going to get you for this, Lucifer. But he also, I think, feels betrayed that Adama and them just left him there to die. But he doesn't really mention that as he's trapped. He's just like, as long as I live, I'm going to get Lucifer back for this, you know?
Yeah, because we see that Lucifer has ambitions of his own. That's where he mentions that he happens to be the same model as the leader, and implying that he's just as suited to lead himself. And then he also is sitting in that chair, that the commander's chair, or whatever it is that Balthazar was sitting in.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they're always facing the opposite direction of the door when you come in.
Yeah.
It's like, and spin around. But so I think, yeah, Lucifer clearly has some ambitions of his own. But Boomer and the other recovering pilots, they do show up on the bridge to say, you know, we want to go into battle, and Even though they can hardly stand up, Boomer points out that they fly the plane sitting down, so it doesn't matter if they can stand or not.
Yeah.
So they go out to help out, even though they're still recovering.
Yeah, and they needed to be helped out because the Cylons were taking out a lot of those female pilots, like left and right. They must have showed like them shoot three of them out of the sky immediately,
Yeah.
before our pilots started to the Centurion. What are they called? I can't remember what they're called.
What
The
the
fighter
ships?
pilots. They have like a name, but I don't know what they're called.
Yeah. I always forget too.
Yeah, but anyway, they were lose they lost I think there were two girls that were like they looked very like twins or something. They always seemed to be talking to each other on the pl they actually got shot, like they got blown up. And then the one woman, the black fighter pilot woman that was badass last episode, she's also badass in this episode. Like she's the
Yeah.
one that took a knack to fighting better than any of them. Like
Right.
Starbuck had to snap her out of it because she started to freak out for a bit, but Starbuck says, you got this. And once she snapped out of it, she was she shot like I think three of them out of the air, and then Starbuck started to shoot them too, and then the rescue team came and the Cylons had to flee. But on Cobol, the Cylons actually landed. They actually landed some of their planes, and they end up near outside the pyramid, and that's where one of the big plot points happens in this storyline is Serena gets shot,
Yeah.
and it's terminal. So that they had to basically take a dying Serena back on board to the Galactica before all the Cylons retreated. And maybe there's enough Cylons in there to find Baltar. I don't know if that's how he gets freed. We're left with like an open ending there. But there was some real I don't know if you found it as interesting as I did, but in the same episode that they got married, she died. That was pretty deep, I thought.
Yeah, the only thing about that I think was that I think I knew that Jane Seymour was not permanently on the show,
Yeah,
that
because
she
you say special guest Jane Seymour. Why would she be a special guest if she's in the credits, if she, wasn't on all the episodes?
Yeah, so I kind of knew that she wasn't something was going to happen eventually. If she wasn't going to get killed, that there was something that was going to take her away. So it took away some of the surprise of it, but.
But even if that was true, did you think it would happen the same episode that they got married?
Yeah, in some ways, the fact that they did get married and the reason that they got married was because they might, one of them, something might happen to one of them. It almost kind of foreshadowed it, kind of to me.
Yeah.
So it kind of made me expect that she was gonna get taken out, especially as we got closer to the attack on the base and stuff that, or attack on the planet by the Cylons as they were kind of trying to escape. I sort of thought. Saw it coming a bit,
Yeah.
but that said, I mean, I thought overall it was really good. The show's been really good so far.
Thought it was unique to her discussion with Boxy because it was weird. No soldier's gonna cry and you're gonna be a soldier, but his mom is dying.
Right, and Apollo standing right behind him.
Standing
All
right behind him, yeah. And he's crying. And he's a
exactly,
soldier.
right. So yeah, it was weird that the one
Yeah.
thing that sound I had trouble I had to turn it up. I had trouble hearing what she was saying,
Yeah.
but I had with trouble with the sound in the episode because I would have it turned up to hear the dialogue, and then it would switch to a space fight, and
And then it would be really
it
loud.
was super loud. I had to turn it down because the phasers and stuff were blasting my eardrums,
Well, for
but.
me, it's a little different because I'm deaf in the one ear. So yeah. I watch most of my shows closed caption. So
okay.
I sometimes read more than I do hear it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So yeah, I got most of the dialogue through the closed caption anyway. Because I would have probably had trouble hearing it as well, because she was speaking in mumbles. But she never told Boxy that she loved him either. But she's during that whole scene, you know, it was kind of odd.
Yeah.
But they all said goodbye to her, and that's kind of how it ended.
Yeah, pretty much.
I really am liking it. Like I'm surprised how much that I forgot. I mean, give or take, you know, I saw this when I was, in my early 10 and 11 or 12 or whatever, but I forgot a lot of the details. Like I always remembered the fight scenes and, you know, things that stood out when you're a kid that don't, but as far as the plot points, it's like watching it for the first time again, you know?
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. So I was really pleased with the way this is panning out so far. I don't know if it goes off the rails later, but it leads us into a question we got from Martin, who's the commander of the Nerdy Legion podcast. He does the Valiant Central and Nerdy Legion and several other, the Aftershock comic podcast. But he says, I guess this gets into the brunch question. He says, why isn't everything bacon flavored? Well,
because then I would have nothing to eat.
Yeah, then you'd have nothing to eat.
Well, actually, I don't mind bacon flavor.
Did
actually.
You ever like bacon?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I mean, like a breakfast meat, or because you haven't always been, you know, eating non-meat, right?
Right, and
you're like Bomer. You ate meat before.
Yeah, and I mostly don't eat meat for dietary reasons. So it's not as if I just was disgusted by the taste or anything. Mm-hmm. I like the flavor of bacon. I actually have had, since becoming a vegetarian, I've had
soy bacon.
Well, yeah, that too. But I've also had a Bloody Mary that was made with bourbon that has bacon flavor, and that may mean that there's some bacon in there somehow or something like that. But I'm not too worried about it. Like I said,
the alcohol will take it out.
Yeah, burn it away.
Oh, burn it away.
I don't
away.
Know how they. So I don't ask questions how they got the flavor.
Well, Martin does like a good drink while he's podcasting, so maybe he can get a bacon flavored drink.
There you go.
I love bacon. I'll put bacon on anything, but I don't like when you start getting into desserts and stuff. I don't like want a bacon flavored smoothie or something like that. sometimes it gets a little too weird, but I like bacon on pizza. I definitely like it in breakfast. That's primary time I eat bacon.
Yeah.
But I like it with my green beans. I like it with pretty much everything for flavoring. So I like it in my salad, like bacon bits. That's good. I've been eating a lot of salad lately, but,
like it in your pocket.
Yeah, in my pocket, bacon in your pocket. You never know when you'll need it. Barbara loves bacon too. We both love bacon. One thing we don't like is turkey bacon. You know, we've converted over a lot to turkey just because it's a better dietary alternative.
Right.
As far as fats and what it has in it.
So, yeah, less
like,
fat.
We'll eat like turkey, ground beef and all kinds of stuff that's turkey related, but we could not get into turkey bacon.
Hmm.
It's just not good.
I think I've had it before. I've had it. It's been a long time because my mom, growing up, my mom at some point switched over to a lot of turkey instead of red meat also.
Yeah.
So yeah, we would do the ground turkey and stuff for tacos and things like that instead.
Yeah. And then the next question is BSG related. That's why I decided to do it now. He says, "Are you got do you guys prefer the original BSG to the reboot?" And I think you kind of and he says special effects aside. So I'll go first because I've watched both of them.
Right. Yeah, it's more of a question for you, really.
Yeah. But I think the special effects, I'm gonna answer your question in terms of special effects. I think the special effects are better in the old one than the new one. I just think the look and feel of the Cylons, because the Cylons in the new one, they're more like human based. And yes,
Yeah, I didn't know
they
that.
have they have the other tier of Cylon that is the robot, but you hardly ever see them. So special effects wise, the way the ships and stuff look, I think they're way better in the original. And I might say, like early on, the new BSG, I liked the it's a little more sophisticated, a little more plot interesting, a little more depth.
Yeah.
But as it became into the closer to the end with the religious stuff, it started to like lose my interest. Like I stopped to like, and that's weird because I like love reading religion in comic books like Lucifer and Phantom Stranger and stuff like that. But in the Galactic didn't work for me, and maybe it's just because of the I was so close to the source material as a child that it kind of took me away, took me out of it. And when we're watching this series, even though I hated Battlestar Galactica 1980 when they actually find Earth, I am gonna watch it because I want to. Even though I don't remember it fondly, I want to see it again. And it's on
Yeah.
Netflix, so I'm going to
Yeah, I
continue.
noticed that. Kind of curious myself.
So my preference is going to be against the norm because I think the majority, not the normal, I think the majority of people would say they like the new one as opposed to the old one. But I have that retro bias, I guess. I guess you could say it that I held it so close to my heart as a kid that I'd much rather watch the old stuff. Plus,
Yeah,
it's more
that's.
straightforward. It's more straightforward science fiction.
Yeah, that's my impression that the new one's a lot more popular. I'm looking forward to going back to it, and I don't know that I necessarily, would have felt that I had to watch the original first, but since we are, I'm just gonna wait. And I think it'll actually increase my, because it's been.
Oh, you're gonna get even a better appreciation, I think, because you'll have the old like fresh in your head. Like
Yeah.
this is I'm revisiting the old like many years later and many years later after the Sci-Fi Channel aired it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you go into it soon, you'll have all these as fresh memories, and you'll be able to make like a better comparison, contrast the different things that are in the show, and you might see a lot more similarity that I'm not seeing, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think it'll be kind of cool to check it out that way. Because what I think it'll actually do in this project will actually get me to finally make the effort to get around to watching that, because I've meant to at times. I started to at one point, and it's always kind of been on the list of me of shows for me to check out at some point. But so I think it'll increase my curiosity.
Well, your co-host on the other show, him and his wife were watching the new Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I remember seeing him mentioning that.
And his wife is enjoying it, so it's like a show that they could watch together. I'm really
Yeah.
curious to see when they get towards the end what they think.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I know some of the cast and how Katie Sackhoff plays Starbuck,
Yeah, and
and
almost Edward
Boomer's a
James
woman too.
Olmos. Yeah, Edward James Olmos is
Adama.
yeah, Adama.
Yeah, didn't she keep the
Apollo's the closest to look and feel like as the character. He's closer to the actor, Richard Hatch.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of took a look at the
And it's
cast.
Not the Richard Hatch that was in Survivor, so just...
Yeah, different.
He's very, very different. Well, thank you for the question, Martin, and check out the Nerdy Legion.
There so, you go.
Now we can jump into comic books. I have comic three books. Today. And
yeah,
surprisingly,
me too.
No DC.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'll continue. I'll keep the DC bias going because I've got some DC.
Yeah, this is surprisingly. I'll go ahead and start because I think you started last time. So,
okay.
I talked about the last time. I talked about Spider-Man, the McFarlane. So I'm gonna talk about issues 2 through 13, but I'm gonna do it in such a synopsis that it'll sound like just one issue. I'm not gonna go panel by panel or anything. But
that would take a long time.
A lot of interesting observations. The first story arc seems to be my favorite so far when McFarlane launched this. His Spider-Man is very dark. Very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And he has the lizard, and he has this character that's never named, but she's obviously a lover of Kraven the Hunter, that is a magician, and she like takes over. She's able to take over like creatures that have some kind of animalistic behavior. So she could take over like spider, even though it's insect. She could do the lizard, and she has like manipulation stuff. And that's what the first arc deals with, and I like the way McFarlane never really tells you her motivation other than some of the back panels on Kraven. It never even names her, and that was pretty amazing. The other thing I thought was very interesting that I didn't remember that was very different from the Spider-Man run is that he wrote, he drew, and he lettered the comic book. So he did a lot on the Spider-Man book. And I think he had more editorial control than he did when he was on Amazing Spider-Man writing for Michelini. So his panel layouts are very, very different. Like when you get a full splash, you get a lot of rendering, but I think he took like these weird shortcuts with these triangles that kind of gave like a really close up. But it was a way that he could still tell the story, but not have to render as much detail. He draws Mary Jane really beautiful, but I don't like the way he writes her. He writes her at such a one-dimensional way that it's like her depth is, okay, I understand my husband. I love I love Peter, but I have to go party every night that he's gone. Even when he gets back, let's go out nightclubbing. Like she just seems so shallow. And, I don't remember not liking it, but I don't like her as much on the second read. Cause I've always been a fan of Mary Jane as opposed to Gwen. Cause I didn't get much of Gwen as a kid. Like I knew she died and I had all the backstory. Cause when I started reading Spider-Man, it was way after her death.
Yeah,
and so I would always get Gwen in like the flashback. So I always, I always would side with Mary Jane. But in this book, man, I'm like, man, I just don't really care for her. But he kind of defeats her. But there's like these questions, like there was a huge explosion and you think she might die in the explosion, but I don't think she did. She's a witch, essentially. And she wears like Kraven, like a Kraven, you know how he has the eyes on his chest? Well, she has the eyes over her boobs, her nipples, but and she's got the Kraven shorts and stuff, but she's very different than Kraven. She's not really a hunter, she's a witch, like a priestess witch. And then the themes of this book are really strange, and they remind me a lot of Spawn, because his themes are darker, they involve a lot of the homeless, which Spawn is based on, you know, like a lot of what Spawn is the homeless. And he must have had a thing for like he must have been like anti-abuse for children or something, because he focuses a lot on kids. The second arc deals with Hobgoblin, and it's about Hobgoblin killing this kid's mother and absorbing him, like turning him into an actual demon, because at this point Hobgoblin was really part demon. And it involves a Ghost Rider story arc, because Ghost Rider tries to come after Hobgoblin, and the Spider-Man is tr in this these this arc is actually trying to save the child, even though his face is disformed and becomes the demon. The child starts to look up to Hobgoblin as his actual mentor and father, and Spider-Man has to try to stop that from actually happening. But they defeat Hobgoblin, and Ghost Rider ends up leaving. But the third arc also involves death of children, and there's a bunch of kids that are murdered in Canada, and Spider-Man is sent there, not Spider-Man, but Peter Parker, to take photos and learn more for J. Jonah Jameson to find out what's happening, because it's like a Sasquatch story. They're blaming the murders on a Sasquatch. And a bunch of
Oh,
these
right.
hunters and stuff, they're going up to the mountains and they're just slaughtering everything they see. So they're killing like innocent animals all over the place. And that's what involves Wolverine, because Wolverine is very close to the animals. And he's like, "What the hell are you doing?" Well, the Sasquatch turns out to be Wendigo. And Wendigo doesn't even eat human meat. They just happen to see the Wendigo over a child as he ran into the child. And saw the dead body naked, and they had like the murders had actually like weird things with them, where you would think, well, who's murdering these kids? Why would the kid be naked in one murder and then not naked in another? And then Peter started asking questions. There was a reporter from the Vancouver Times that was using this to exploit her career rather than tell the truth. So she was trying to go through the Sasquatch, approach, even though Spider-Man knew after a while, especially when he tagged up with Wolverine, that the Wendigo, like he has to babysit the Wendigo at one time as Wolverine goes into town looking for the hunter that's actually hunting and killing all the animals, and find out what's going on. And then he tries to convince reporters down there that they have to tell the truth. He confronts the woman from the Vancouver Times and says, let's look at the facts. And he does change her opinion on things. But all these they, there were three kids that were murdered, and none of it was the Wendigo. It was a police officer that was killing these kids. So that was two arcs back to back with like violence towards children, which was interesting. I really like the portrayal of Wolverine more so than Ghost Rider, the way he was portrayed in this comic book. He was empathetic towards the animals. He was empathetic towards protecting Wendigo. It had mentions of Alpha Flight. It was pretty. He also had, I don't know how much editorial help, but things to like tie in stuff. And then the final arc dealt with the homeless. And Morpheus basically had these homeless people, underground homeless people that are deformed. They're not Morlocks, though, because they're not mutants. These were just like homeless people that lived underground that became like deformed from living underground for so long, not seeing sunlight. And what you really see here is one of the lead homeless guys that actually that lives underground, hunts down homeless, takes them into the sewer, and then feeds them to Morbius, which is that vampire. So Morbius is that one doctor that was bitten by a vampire, and he has that superhero looking costume, and he thinks he's getting fed from these homeless people. Vile people like criminals and such, because that's what they're telling him. These people that live underground are saying, "We're the good people. We're only capturing bad people and bringing them down here for you to eat." And then he in turn feeds them and clothes them. So And this is when he gets the black costume. I noticed you mentioned it on one of my Facebook posts that you liked that the return of the black costume. And the reason the black costume came back was for stealth, because first time that Spider-Man went into the sewers, he thought that he was too visible to these people, and then he would be at a disadvantage because he wasn't stealth, and they would see him right away and then attack him and then overcome him by sheer numbers. So he basically went to the house and said, I'm going to put on the black costume, even though it's not really Venom. And Mary Jane was like, do you know what Venom did to me? You know, that costume, I hate this costume. You can't wear it. And he said, honey, I need to. I need to do it for stealth. But later on, he finds out that the costume did him absolutely no good whatsoever. So that was interesting. Because the costume was kind of just put there thinking it would help him, but it didn't help him at all. They still knew he was in the sewers. They still attacked him. And it kind of ends like with the continuity that Morbius was left with Doctor Strange during this time frame to try to have a cure, and then he left because they couldn't find a cure. And that's when he went underground, and he got tired of stalking people, so he had these underground people do it for him. And he said he needed the blood. He was losing control, and Spider-Man tries to talk him down, but he can't. And he kind of escapes, depressed that he finds out that these homeless that he was using were taking innocent people, innocent homeless, and he starts to freak out because Morbius is kind of like a good vampire, but he needs to eat. He needs to be fed. Yeah. So he thought he was taking out bad people, and he wasn't. They were just feeding him anybody they could find up on the streets.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed this, and I'm reading it not in the monthly form, but I'm reading it in the Todd McFarlane. I have all the original issues, but rather than dig through long boxes and reading them, I'm just reading the omnibus, which contains 1 through 13 and then has a two-part crossover with Spider-Man and X-Force, and that's how it ends. So it's a pretty good book if you're a fan of and there's a lot of like stuff, extra materials in the back, like letters pages and extra covers and all kinds of Wizard magazine covers and trivia and all kinds of other stuff they have in it too. So nice. There's a lot of extras, but I'm enjoying
it. I was a huge McFarlane fan when prior to that series coming out, and so I was right there when it launched and read the whole thing as it was coming out. That was one of my top books at the time. And I really made an effort and made sure to get the Spider-Man and the X-Men stuff at that time. And yeah, it's neat to hear you talk. And I haven't read it since then. You know, so it's been, well, it was like 91, 92 that came out, around there.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time, but hearing you talk, it's cool to hear you talk about it, because it brings me back to the details I forgot and stuff.
It's amazing how much that the one lead homeless guy that's bringing things to Morbius looks like the Violator clown. Like it looks, there's some panels in there. You're like, that's the Violator clown. And that clown used to drive a car. If you're familiar with Spawn, you read Spawn, right? The early stuff.
Only the first handful of issues.
Yeah, but the handful of issues that McFarlane did early on, he had that clown driving a ice cream car, and he was picking up children to kill them. So it's really interesting how this kind of flowed, ideas from this and the homeless and everything kind of flowed into the Spawn book.
Yeah, looking back, it's pretty clear he was working out ideas.
Oh yeah.
You know,
it's a much darker place. So I'm really interested. I'm going to finish this omnibus probably by next weekend. If not today, if I have time today, I'll finish the last two issues that he did. Just because it's, I expect a lighter tone because it's a team up with X-Force. So I wonder what it's going to be like, because I remembered it back in the day, but I don't have any memory of that. But I did remember these issues, especially the team ups. Like, I remember he teamed up with Ghost Rider and Wolverine, and he had that big opening story arc with the Lizard. But it's fun to revisit this stuff. It really is, from an historical perspective and also from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah, even though I've heard you describe it, I have to go back and check it out some point. Some of that other stuff that I read at that time. It's because some of those images, as you talk about them, it was coming back to me as you read, and then some of it I still just remember to this day regardless, because I was definitely a huge fan at the time.
Yeah.
Really. So it'd be cool to take a look at it again. Well, last weekend I went to a local con around here. I actually met Rob, my co-host on Booster Club, there, and we hung out, and we talked about it a bit on the episode we recorded Friday night that should be coming out. But I did some shopping while I was there. There was one vendor that Rob and I both, probably the majority of the stuff that we both bought was from there, because they had most of their stuff were issues were $3 each, but then as soon as you hit 10 issues, they became $2 no matter if you bought 11 or 12. You didn't have to buy them in increments of 10 at that point. So for $2, these were not stuff that you usually see at that price. It was a lot of late Bronze Age, early 80s, late 70s kind of stuff that you usually see more for $3 to $5 or whatever. So there were some good buys there. And the reason I'm saying all that is one of the issue that I'm going to talk about is from there. It's an issue that DC Comics Presents, which we talked about a number of those on this podcast in the past. This issue is issue 76, which is a team up with Wonder Woman, which I grabbed this one because I'm a Wonder Woman fan, but also because I don't see this issue for sale a lot. And I wasn't really sure why, besides Wonder Woman tends to be more scarce, but that's really with her solo series. The print runs aren't as high. But as I was reading this actually has a monitor appearance in it. Pre-crisis monitor appearance.
What number is this?
76.
Okay.
And that monitor appearance is not really connected to the issue, as a lot of them weren't. We just happened to see, it takes place on one page in the middle of the issue, where we just happened to see the monitor and Lila watching the events of the issue, watching Superman and Wonder Woman, and discussing it, and that they're going to kind of keep an eye on what's going on as a chance to watch their teamwork. But otherwise, this story is called Living Clay, Killing Clay. It was written by Dan Mishkin and Gary Cohn, with art by Eduardo Barreto, and Gene D'Angelo was the colorist. It's edited by Julius Schwartz, lettered by Ben Oda. So a whole lot of DC Comics names there, familiar DC Comics names. And it opens up with Diana Prince as Major Prince. She's working with a guy who she's monitoring this new technology that this gentleman, Dr. Terhune.
I hate to break it here, but you said 76?
Yes.
Volume 2?
DC Comics Presents.
Oh, DC Comics Presents. Okay, that's where I was lost.
What were you looking at?
I was looking at Wonder Woman.
Oh.
So I was like, this can't be right.
No, no. Yeah, DC Comics Presents.
Gotcha.
Team up with Wonder Woman.
Because I was like, those writers, man, I don't remember them doing a lot.
Yeah, I can see where that would be confusing. So, let's see. So, this Dr. Terhune, he has this device that you can fire on something and it actually causes regeneration. So they fire it on a forest that is withered and it causes the... well, it depends on the setting. In this case, they fire it in a forest and it causes the forest to wither. And then it all actually grows back. So there are military applications for that are kind of obvious, but Diana Prince wants to make sure that everything is handled responsibly. But unfortunately, right after they test the device, there's the earth rumbles and this huge creature emanates from the earth. And it actually looks like a sort of, well, it's a huge creature, but also has technological devices adhered to it. So this is kind of weird amalgam. And just to give you a sense of the scale, there are little pods on just back of its head that actually have men inside firing weapons. So they're kind of riding this creature. So obviously, Diana changes into Wonder Woman to try to rescue Dr. Terhune from the men that we had seen, these sort of hooded men with jetpacks on that they had seen on top of the creature. And she's not actually able to save him, but tries to get one of the men with her lasso. She causes him to trip, but then she gets blasted out with the laser from one of the devices on top of the creature. And so then the creature, it burrows its way back into the earth. She starts to follow down the tunnel that it's created, and she's surprised to see that the tunnel floor, as she pursues it, the tunnel floor, it was solid rock, and then it starts to change consistency, and it's more covered in kind of a slippery, slimy substance. And she gets to a point at which she can't pursue any further because the tunnel is blocked off. But she, I'm not sure why, but she has a clue somehow that the creature is headed towards Metropolis. And so we switch over to Metropolis and we see Superman, and there's a monstrosity that's attached to a building downtown, and it seems to, it's a, of a similar color and consistency to the worm-like creature that Wonder Woman was battling, and it also similarly has technological devices attached to it. But this one is more of, it has a bunch of tendrils like an octopus sort of would, and it attacks this woman inside of an office building as Superman joins the fight. And Superman's able to get with his strength, he's able to pull the creature off of the building and start to fly it away. And as he's flying away with it, he actually starts to have sort of a similar experience as to Wonder Woman, in that the creature that he's flying with over its head, it starts to kind of disintegrate somewhat, or it transforms into a more gooey material that seems like clay to him. So he deposits the creature in the ocean, and as he's flying back towards Metropolis, he gets attacked by pterodactyl-like creatures that have laser blasters on their back. So kind of continuing the theme is what we saw. And We see a figure is watching all this on a monitor from a distance, and it's not the monitor, but he is. This is where the sort of this is where they work in that scene that I talked about earlier. That because of the comparison or the of characters watching what's going on monitors, and this is where the two heroes team up as Wonder Woman arrives under an invisible jet and aids Superman in his fight against the pterodactyl-like creatures. And once again, as they start to gain the upper hand, the creatures start to devolve into what looks like clay. So Superman leads Wonder Woman to the building that the octopus-like creature had been attacking. It's a headquarters of a company called CC Biotechnologies. And when they break in, the woman that was getting attacked originally by the octopus creature is recognized by Wonder Woman as a woman named Christina. And I don't know if that's just for the story or if she actually, I didn't get a chance to research if she actually has appeared before. But in any event, it's Wonder Woman demands that Christina tell her where Dr. Terhune is. But Christina is not intimidated. She says she has powers of her own, and she actually causes some of that sort of clay, darkish brown-like material to rise up from the floor and start to entrap the two heroes. Well, Superman is pretty, it's pretty easy for him to break free, but Diana has difficulty doing so, and that connects back to her origin of being created from clay at this point, her pre-crisis origin. And so Wonder Woman, she's struggling to get free of this clay-like substance. She explains that the woman's full name is Christine Cade, C-A-D-E, and that so we have like a bit of a flashback that that Diana found her Paradise Island. Christina was a survivor of a shipwreck, and she washed ashore, and they were friends as children. They hung out together, and that Christina had a real aptitude for science, spent a lot of time with Paula, the Amazon's scientist, and eventually, later, Christina, excited, she rushes up to Diana. They seem a bit older now, and she tells Diana she's discovered how to do something, but she never gets a chance to tell Diana what that is because Athena appears to them, tells Christina that she has learned what mortals were never meant to tamper with, and she tells her to promise that she will forsake her experiments. Well, as you might expect, she did not forsake those experiments. And as far as Wonder Woman knows, Christina went missing the following day. And so it turns out she had left Paradise Island, and what she had discovered were the basics of giving life to clay as Wonder Woman was created. And so she went back to civilization and founded this company and has created these creatures as a result of what she has learned. And she explains that she abducted Dr. Terhune because of the process he's developed. Christina's clay creatures can only animate, as we've seen with their disintegration throughout the story so far, they can only remain animate for a short period of time, and she thinks that Dr. Tahune's experiments will be the key to figuring that out. Well, obviously Superman and Wonder Woman aren't having it. Superman starts to attack her henchmen, and she tries to overwhelm him with them, but while this is going on, Wonder Woman continues to be swallowed up by the clay, and then she actually reverts back to her clay form. She becomes sort of basically a clay version of Wonder Woman, and that allows Christina to take control over her actions, and she sends Wonder Woman after Superman. And so the two of them, so Superman has to fight a clay composed version of Wonder Woman for a few pages. But Superman finally gets her to kind of shock out of the control by pointing out to her some regular citizens that are in danger because of her actions. And she actually lassos herself. And so that is what she is, how she's able to escape from the clay status. She transforms back into the regular Wonder Woman. And so now they are able to start to work toward together to get people from the building to safety. They're able to find Dr. Terhune and rescue him. And so then as they battle the two, or they battle through a bunch of the henchmen that Christine has and finally make it to her. And as she and Wonder Woman began to struggle against each other, we see Christine devolves herself into a kind of primitive man, but made out of clay. And it seems that she used the formula on herself, and she basically signed her own death warrant, as she puts it, because of the experiments that she did on herself to try to make herself more powerful. So a sort of tragic status for her. And so she fights Wonder Woman, Superman, somewhat futilely. In one scene, Wonder Woman actually throws her, and she just comes up against the immovable object that is Superman. She just slams against his chest as he hardly seems to matter. But they're actually, you know, as heroes, trying to subdue her to get her to relax so that they can try to do something to reverse the process. But as Superman is holding her in place, she unfortunately disintegrates into her in his hands and disappears. So it has a sad and tragic ending. The issue ends with just the two heroes discussing how science and knowledge can be used for good or evil, as Wonder Woman flies away, and we see that Dr. Terhune is in the back seat of the invisible jet. She's taking him away. So it was a fun issue. It was a fun surprise to see the monitor appearance in there. But I really enjoy, I like Eduardo Barreto's art. He inks himself in this issue, and he does kind of the Kirby style of the first page is, you know, has several panels, but then as you flip open, it's actually the second and third, and it's a semi-splash page. There's the top third has a bunch of panels, but the bottom two thirds is a splash that shows the worm creature smashing out of the earth, and Diana Prince below it. Just something about the dynamic positioning, posing of Diana in the foreground is really nice. But just throughout, a lot of nice composition of the battles, a lot of way panels are composed with the fights between, the various fights between Wonder Woman and Superman and the henchmen and the different clay creatures, even though we don't really have like a well-known villain or and the henchmen are, you know, kind of nondescript. They actually kind of look like little Dr. Fates because of their helmets. And the coloration of those are just kind of a goldish color from top to bottom. So that's a little, it makes them look a little generic, but yeah, it was a good issue, a good one and done, which make these a good choice for the show usually.
Now the cover looks amazing. I really like the cover.
Yeah, and the cover's by Eduardo Barreto as well. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because it is a neat cover. It kind of caught my eye.
It kind of looks like Garcia Lopez, but not. I mean, just the style of it, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think Barreto has sort of a similar style to Garcia Lopez. You can like I said, you can tell a difference, but I like Barreto and. Yeah, it's sort of neat how you see the creature that Christina eventually devolves into in the background. She's rather large enough that in each of her hands she's holding the Wonder Woman logo in one hand, and then she's holding not really the traditional Superman logo, but the name Superman and sort of like rock like letters. And Superman and Wonder Woman are struggling in some green.
Yeah, because what she's doing is cracking it. She's cracking the logos.
Yeah,
by squeezing them. Yeah, that's kind of neat.
And I think it's interesting coloring choice that I think just to sort of break up. They made the clay green on the cover.
Yeah.
And I have to guess it's brown in the issue, and I think they just made that
to
choice
make it more colorful.
Popped a bit more against the red and the blue and yellow of Wonder Woman and Superman's costumes.
Like here you can't tell it's clay. It looks more like goo.
yeah, goo or just kind of like some kind of tendrils of some sort of sea creature or something. But it was probably the right choice because it probably would look like they were like struggling in like a whole bunch of feces or poop or something. Dirt, maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
That was a good one.
Well, my next one is a story I haven't read before. So this is, well, two of them are stories I haven't read before. But this one is Thor 383. And it is an untold tale from Secret Wars. And it's by Tom DeFalco and Rob Friends. It's Thor 383, and this one I really, really enjoyed. I've always been a sucker for Enchantress and her sister, Lorelei. I don't know how to pronounce it, Lorelei. Lorelei has always been popular to me from the Walt Simonson run. I remember her distinctively. So they are sisters, and the story opens up with this battle. His name is Dalius the Daring, and he's like breaking through this bridge fighting an ogre of some sort, protecting the bridge and going through all these traps and stuff just to get to Lorelei. And when he gets there, he's like, I've loved you my whole life, my whole goal was to find you, to see if you existed, and you know the poets always sung of your beauty and that they didn't do it justice because you're beyond that. And he says, I'm willing to sacrifice and do anything for you, because he's like infatuated with her. And she basically kisses him and turns him to stone and laughs about it. She thinks it's funny. And then the Enchantress comes down and says, why did you do that to this poor guy who envied you? You don't know what you're missing. And she like makes fun of her sister, the Enchantress, saying, well, you're with boring old Heimdall, who's the guardian of the Rainbow Bridge. And she treats that as disrespectful. You know, I have to have Thor or somebody big, Thor or Loki. Why would I settle for anybody less like this other guy? And then she starts telling the story of Battleworld, which is really cool because from Secret Wars where the Beyonder put them all in a battle world where the good – these actually spawn toys, you know, if you don't know, the Secret Wars toys. Mm-hmm. You had the villains. They had goofy shields, like this hieroglyphic shields. And
oh, yeah.
The figures were not very bendable. Like if you were to compare the Secret Wars figures – which came out about the same time as the Superpowers ones. The Superpowers toys from DC were very more articulate. You could bend at the knees, at the elbows and such. And some of them had like twisty powers. The Marvel heroes at this time, they only could do at the hip, you know, like at the leg joint where the leg joins the hip. And then at the arm joints, you could just move those. They came with this, everyone came with the hieroglyphic shield and like Wolverine claws would snap on and stuff like that. I have quite a few of the toys. Not a lot of the villains. I might have like Doctor Doom and a few of the villains. I wish I had them all. And they went on Battleworld. And at this point, this happened, where this story happens is kind of like right when the Molecule Man drops the mountain on top of the good guys, essentially all of them, and Hulk has to hold it up or they all die. But the villains had the upper hand. And during this time, Enchantress, before he dropped the mountain on them, Thor went, they had already Enchantress captured. So the good guys had Enchantress captured in this tube. They had a few of the other villains captured as well. And he went to free her. Thor freed her without the allies knowing that he freed her, just so he can talk to her, because he needed somebody that he could relate to. They were the only gods that were on Battleworld, and he wanted to talk to her. Well, the Enchantress has always loved Thor, so she comes up with a potion, and she's like, well, if he kisses me, I will have him love me forever. But Thor doesn't, and he's like, stand back, woman. And then a monster comes out, and he has to save her from the monster. And then they start talking, and he says, if you want my love, you have to earn it. Love doesn't just come from a kiss. It comes from caring about somebody. And she says, well, man, I really could be somebody that Thor could love if I could just turn good. And that's when Molecule Man drops the mountain on all the heroes while Thor's away. Thor has to find them. So he zaps back because they felt that the whole shattering on Battleworld, they felt it throughout the world. And he spins his hammer, goes back to where they were, takes Enchantress there, and all the villains are there. All the villains, Absorbing Man, Doctor Doom, the Wrecker, you know, all of the... they're all there. Molecule Man, Dr. Octopus, and he has to fight all of them at once, including Ultron. I mean, we're talking some big foes he has to fight. And he's able to hold them all off, except Dr. Doom enhances Ultron, and he blasts him, and they think him dead. And this whole time that this battle's going on, Enchantress is like, I should help him. I love you. And It's very traumatic because she doesn't get the courage to help him at all, and they think he's dead, but he obviously doesn't die. And her whole message to her sister was for naught, because as soon as the Enchantress leaves and she's crying, she got real emotional, remembering that she could have had Thor. Lorelei is there, and she's just laughing at that the guy she turned to stone. So it was a really cool story. And I am a huge fan of this creative team, Tom DeFalco and Rob Franz. I think they work so well together. The art style I've always loved. Where I know them really, where I've really become attached to them, they've done a lot of books together, but where I really became attached to them is their work on Spider-Girl. And I've never read this Untold story, and I absolutely loved it. This is coming off the Epic Collection. Mm-hmm. I've been on an Epic Collection kick. I'm becoming infatuated with the way these are put together. I'm starting to really love it.
Yeah, it took you a while to come around on this.
Rabbit hole, yeah. They're not chronological. Like, this one's volume 16. And these are stories I have some of these stories, but I was collecting Marvel very sporadically. So I have quite a few of the DeFalco runs, but I don't have a lot of them. Mm-hmm. I'm about 50% probably, but I really enjoyed this story. I was glad I picked it up. So right now I have entire Captain America epic run, and I'm working on Thor. And I have a few others coming. I like have Daredevil and the Hulk so far. I think there's only one volume of the Hulk that just came out. But yeah, I almost want to be a completist on him because I think I would have felt differently like if I would have jumped on the Essentials, even though they're black and white. The reason I didn't jump on the Essentials because they were black and white. But the more and more as time passed, I didn't care that they were black and white. So I have like a few Essentials of like Doctor Strange and Ghost Rider and some of the monster books. Mm-hmm. But I'm really liking these epic collections and I'd like to have them all.
This is funny because I remember when they first started coming out and I got some. And
yeah, you talked about some of the Fantastic Four ones, I remember.
Yeah, I think it was the fact that they weren't chronological that was bugging you.
Yeah.
But
they make sense, though. Like, you can pick up any volume and it's more focused on where they were. Do you know what I mean?
Well, they're always...
And by creative team.
They're always fairly decent jumping on points, yeah. So you can pick them up and
anywhere,
read them.
Anywhere, right, mm-hmm. out of sequence, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, and eventually they'll fill in, but it'll take a while. But I'm glad to see that they're still doing them, and it seems even like they're keeping them in print, too, because some of the early ones that came out, you can still get them. I don't know, Marvel's just so much better than DC when it comes to stuff like that. I'd wish DC would change their game when it comes to some stuff.
I like they're doing good with like the new Titans. They're coming out with some of the volumes, but I don't know how far they're going to get.
Yeah.
And every time they start something, they don't finish it.
Exactly.
They don't get far enough. Like, so they start it. Like right now they have the good omnibuses, the hardcover omnibuses, and I really like them, but how far are they going to go, you know, before they stop?
You can't trust it because they haven't built up any reason for the consumer to trust them that they're going to continue them. And a lot of the stuff that they're doing, like, well, not a lot of stuff, but they do have, like you said, they have signs of where they started those Chronicle lines with Batman, Flash, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, Superman, where they were going to keep publishing those in chronological order. But then they stop them, and I know it has to be because of sales. And
it has to be,
but it's just frustrating.
But as a collector, that's what it's frustrating, because you like invest in this, and it gets you excited, and then it's gone.
And then they're doing this, so now they're doing the Batman, Superman, Flash,
Justice League, yeah.
Justice League, like Golden and Silver Age omnibuses, and then it seems like they're actually taking those and then they're doing trade paperbacks off of those, but it's covering the same material that they've already put into print with the Chronicles.
Yeah, but the Chronicles don't go that far. They're thin.
No, but what they're doing with the, what they're taking that, they're taking the
Chronicles and combining
omnibuses. Yeah. They're taking the omnibuses and they're actually
breaking them up into paperbacks, yeah.
And those cover, you know, it's like, yeah, like they're coming out with like a second volume of the Silver Age Flash, and that does already go farther than the four installments of Chronicles that they put out of the Flash. But they're still like starting from the same point and covering the same material, and they probably won't continue them, and they'll probably get to a certain point. And
but Marvel, you could say the same thing, because they have the Masterworks, and yeah, they're coming out very infrequently, and the Masterworks have gotten ridiculously $75 for 12 issues. That's pretty high, you know? Mm-hmm. So
they kept them going a lot longer though than,
yeah, they're still got them going on. They just came out with the Champions and they have some other ones, but
yeah, they still
have different formats. Like you could say, well, you're doing the Epic, and I already have these volumes inside the Omnibus because they have their Omnibuses too, right? They have the Captain America Omnibus Volume 1, Volume 2, Spider-Man Volume 1, Volume 2, Fantastic Four. I think they have three volumes, Uncanny X-Men, three volumes, two X-Men. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, like, you have to decide either do I have this in, like, hardcover and then I want to switch to Epic and where do I start? And there might be some overlap. Or do you just go all in? I mean, it just depends on your collecting mentality, right?
Yeah. I mean, they do put out the same material in different formats, but when they start a format, they are a lot more, they tend to be
more
dedicated
to
it.
Be dedicated
they'll
to
continue
it, yeah.
It through, like, yes, you can buy the Fantastic Four and omnibuses, but they'll put out at least a number of those omnibuses. And if they do and that's one of the reasons that they did the Epic collections, the way that they're doing them, is because they wanted to put into print stuff instead of starting from the beginning. They wanted to put into print stuff that they didn't have in print, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't really, you know, I'm more of a DC fan these days than a Marvel one, but you know, it's like, I respect the way that Marvel will actually stay committed to a format. 'Cause like you said, even though the Masterworks are more expensive, they still do come out infrequently, but they come out where DC is pretty much just abandoned the archives.
Yeah.
You know, so it would just be cool to see.
I like the archives, and I missed them. Like I missed those chronological ones. I started with the chronological ones. I said, this is a great point for me to start, but I didn't start with the Superman Batman, which I wished I did. I said, I'm going to start with Green Lantern, Flash, and Wonder Woman. Those are the ones I started to buy into. Mm-hmm. And they even did like a Justice League solicit of the chronological ones, and then they never came out with it. So there's that too that happens, is they solicit stuff, and then they look at the numbers and say, well, we got 700 orders. Is it really worth it? Let's not do it.
Well, yeah, and I think that's also when they decided to do the switch over to the omnibuses instead, because they came out with the Justice League Omnibus instead. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it is what it is. I know they have their reasons for doing it. I just wish the reality were different.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, Marvel may just sell better. And so they might do the same thing. Maybe if as DC does, if they had the same numbers, I don't know.
These are fun things, though. I know you got into them for a while there early on when we were doing Retrocast. And I did say, here's why I don't like them. But I don't know what changed. I think I bought a Captain America volume, and I'm like, I love this idea. And I even love the idea that they're out of order. I don't know why, but I think they combine it in very logical ways.
Yeah, they do.
You just jump in and you feel like you get like years worth of comics, couple years worth, and it all feels right together the way it's packaged. Mm-hmm. It captures the time period very, very good.
Yeah, I like the paper that they use.
I don't like it as much as like my favorite paper is the DC paper. Like I love the DC paper on the Jack Kirby stuff.
Yeah.
I love that newsprint stuff. And they use that kind of like more newsprinty types paper on like the Teen Titans and other stuff. And I like that a little better, but this is a good paper. It's a good quality. They're sturdy books too. Like I've had problems with the Essentials where the binding showcasing especially on the first few, like if you're reading the first few stories in the middle, they're fine, but they start to detach on the binding. The binding on this is good. You know, you can read and read and read and they'll still stick.
Yeah, I like the paper on those that you're talking about on like the Kirby collections and stuff better too, but this is kind of like in the middle for me. Like the Epic collections, I like it better than the like super high glossy paper. So they're kind of in the middle.
It's like a happy medium, between the two.
Yeah. Because I'm not as crazy when you take old stuff and and recolor it and then and print it on really glossy paper like they use today, it doesn't look appropriate. Which actually is a nice segue into my next book.
Okay.
Because I picked up another Humble Bundle. This, as we record, it probably will be gone by the time this comes up. As we record, it's still current. It's a Dark Horse one. And it's just stuff from like the 30 years that they've been a company. And included that was the first Chronicles of Conan, which has the first 8 issues of the of what was originally the Marvel series by Roy Thomas and Barry Windsor Smith.
Yeah.
And I've never really read any of these. I've read some of the later, more current Conan stuff that Dark Horse has done. But so I've checked out the first issue of this. And yeah, I mean, so it's not real bad, but it's obviously I can't tell you the consistency or how glossy the paper is because it's digital, but it is recolored. And it doesn't ruin it for me. I'd actually just rather see it look a little closer to how it originally looked. But that aside, I enjoyed the issue. It's called The Coming of Conan. And referring to his arrival, not a sexual escapade.
And this is number one.
Yes.
Yeah. This one I did read.
Yeah.
I own that one, believe it or not. I don't have a lot of Conan, but I own like 1 through 5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you own most of this this collection, but yeah, I won't spend a lot of time on it. It's a pretty straightforward story. And it takes place when Conan is a young man, and he is implied that he's basically a mercenary, and he is involved in a battle between two forces, two cultures. There's the Vanir, and who come from Asgard. And then they are fighting against the, what is the name of the other group? Vanaheim. And so Conan's working with the, I got those mixed up. Those are the Vanaheims where they're from. So it's the Aesir and the Vanir. So Conan's working with the Aesir, and he saves the leader, who's being outnumbered by like 3 guys. He comes into the battle and helps out the leader. And the leaders of the other group, the Vanir, the leader of that group is named Wolf. And him and his advisor, they see that they're pretty much going to lose. So they actually take off. They tell their men to call upon the gods and seek favor, that he and his assistant are going to, that they're going to go call upon the gods to seek favor. And they tell their men to basically hold the pass that they're hold up in, but in truth they're actually just taking off because they know they're going to lose, and they're abandoning their men basically just to buy them time. So they're craven cowards, and but when they leave, they end up going into this chasm that turns out to be a temple, and they find this strange man and a young woman and this large green crystal. And so the old man tells them, I can call up forces to aid you, to bring you victory, but my price is that you bring me the dark-haired Cimmerian that is aiding your foes, meaning Conan, obviously. So as this is going on, Conan and the Aesir attack the Vanir, the men that were left behind. And then suddenly these like winged beasts come flying down and join the battle against Conan and they kill the leader of the Aesir, Olav. And Conan gets captured by one of these winged beasts, and he comes to later, and he's in a cell, and this woman, the woman that we saw with the old man, introduces herself as Tara. And so from his cell, he can see what's going on. This old man, he's a shaman of sorts. He has a vision through this large green crystal, and it shows him the past, and then it shows him the future, and he actually sees Conan being crowned king of an empire. And then the visions continue. It seems like he sees another world that actually looks to be kind of similar to our world, and he sees space travel, and it just is all too much for his mind. And at that moment, Conan breaks free, grabs the crystal, and throws and shatters it against the wall. And as all the destruction is happening from as a result of this, he breaks free, bringing the woman Tara with him to save her. And once they're safe from the explosion, the woman, it turns out, she transforms. Krom's devils, Conan says, she transforms into a winged creature like we saw before. But she explains that the shaman, the old man, had taken her from her own world through that large green stone that he had. He transformed her into the woman that the form that she had been in. The only way that he could keep her in this world forever was to put someone in her place in the world he took her from. And that was to be Conan. That is why was called this. There's the ceremony that the shaman wanted to do was called the ceremony of transferal. And so because of Conan's actions, she's able to disappear and go back to the world that she's from. And basically the story just ends with Conan continuing his journey onward and just contemplating some of the images that he saw, but he's already sort of starting to disregard and forget about them as he leaves. But yeah, I mean, it was a neat story. It kind of foreshadows events of the future, but it starts you off just with Conan as kind of a mercenary, and he's just getting his start.
What format are those bundles in? Just like PDFs or what?
You actually, it adds the bundle to your account, and you can go back and download them at any time. And you have your choice, actually. I know there's PDF, there's CBZ, I think two other formats, but you can download them in any of those formats, or you can
what
download
do you, what do you download it to?
Usually CBZ.
And you have a CBZ reader app on your iPad or what?
Yeah. I have a program on my laptop too. But I've used PDF also because the app I have can use PDF. I think also EPUB. They come in EPUB sometimes, and sometimes there's one more, I think, but those are the main three.
Oh, nice.
So
that seems like a good, like if you even had the trades, that would be a good one to have, the Marvel stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
The one thing that I'm attracted to in these stories is the Winsor Smith art. I think it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty good in this issue. And he's just still going by Barry Smith at this point.
Yeah. The cover is like one of my favorite covers of all time. To that, I just love that cover.
I gotta look it up because I don't know if it shows it in here or not.
That's one of my trade things too. Like even in any collected edition format, I love when they have the cover and then the story, just so I
I
get
agree,
that historical perspective. I don't like, and that they do this a lot too, to make the story more continuous to a reader, is not to have the cover there and then put the covers in the back. I prefer to have it like, so I still have like a little bit of a monthly experience reading my collection. So I like know one is one and two is two. That's just one of my weirdnesses. Like,
No, I don't think it's. I actually agree with you. I feel the same way, and I especially hate it when they try to make it seem like one long, seamless story.
yeah, I don't like that
So you
at
don't.
all.
They try to make it so you can't even tell.
I understand why,
I do too, yeah.
because I'm not a trade reader, but if you're a trade reader, you might want to not think of it like having a breaking point. But like from an historical perspective, even if I was a trade reader, I'd want to know what the cover looked like to that issue. So it's just one of those things.
Yep.
But
I
yeah.
feel the same way, and I what was I gonna say? I gotta do my ratings, you know? Like I need to know which issue is which because I gotta rate them,
Yeah,
just
yeah,
like you
yeah.
do, yeah.
You like
So.
to know what you read rather than saying, I read volume one of this. You rather know, I read number one of Conan the Barbarian, not
Yeah.
Chronicles volume one. I started the first story.
Right. And it was written if it 'cause if it was written as issues, I want to see how it works in that format, you know.
Yeah.
So anyhow,
Yeah, I like it. I only have one more book, and there's not a lot I want to talk about that I read, but I read Beep Beep, The Roadrunner, number 13. It's a 15-cent issue. And I found it really interesting because what I was expecting is like a quick read right before bed, you know, like a quick lighthearted read, because Bugs Bunny Road Cobra, I have a real fondness for the cartoon. And the one thing that's amazing about that cartoon is they do everything without any voice. You know,
Right.
Coyote is trying to capture the
That's
Roadrunner,
true.
and it has adventures, and he's always ordering stuff from Acme and trying to get the latest things so he could, and he never wins, okay? But this story was really jarring for me because I expected a lot of the same. It was like when I read Pink Panther, American Mythology Pink Panther, the first story like that they did was amazing because it captured the essence of what the cartoon was, because the Pink Panther never says a word. It's all silent, and you read it, and things were captured through like thought bubbles, but through like a mona. What do they call the emoticons or whatever? Like he's thinking of something and he sees it in there in his mind. But
Those were emoticons before emoticons.
yeah.
Or emojis.
Emojis, yeah.
They were the original emojis.
So I really dug that when they did it, and then I read like the backup, which was the older stuff, and then I was like, wow, that's Pink Panther talking. It really changes the dynamic of what the animation cartoon did for me, you know what I mean? And this one was kind of more jarring because the Roadrunner spoke in rhymes like the demon. So every sentence that the Roadrunner would say would be rhymed, and he was always talking to his children. He has three kids that he takes around with them, and those kids are annoying as hell. But you're almost like, please, Wally, come up with the right trap, you know? But he never, I mean, one of the interesting ones he came up with in the comic book was a feather magnet, but that didn't pan out. But he was like, I can't catch these birds, so what if I turn a magnet into a feather magnet? And he gets like an old vulture to, he buys a bunch of feathers from a vulture and devises this. He actually designs a feather magnet, and it looks like it's going to work, but he gets a bunch of other birds that want to kick his ass, and he doesn't like that. But it does a lot of crazy. Another one thing that he, one of the other interesting things is the Roadrunner's retired. They need to rest, so they needed to go for a swim to cool off their feet because they're always running, and they're trying to find like some kind of water hole in the desert.
Friction.
So the whole issue was, the whole story was Wile E. Coyote trying to get them to draw them into like pools of water, but they weren't really pools of water. So he'd like paint like water on a rock, and Roadrunner would always like throw something at the rock, and there's no splash. Or this is a mirage. One time he actually did get some water, which was very little water, and made it look like a pool, like they can go swimming in. And Roadrunner did the rock test again, and it splashed, but it barely splashed. And he said, "That's some shallow water as a trap." But the rock that they threw on the water was so big that it cracked a hole in the ground and did actually make a pool. And they trapped Coyote in like one of those lifeguard things, so he couldn't do nothing while they were in the pool swimming. But it had some interesting things. Like the kids were a little annoying, but the Wile E. Coyote stuff I enjoyed. Like it's always fun to watch that. I think it would have had more dramatic effect if it was done without the words. But most of these comics during the time were for kids, and they wanted them to get to read too. So if it was just a silent issue, you're just looking at pictures.
Yeah, that's true.
And then maybe reading off of a box to see what weapon Wile E. Coyote's using. And then there was an interesting Daffy Duck story in there, where Daffy Duck would always smooge off of Elmer Fudd. And I really appreciated the fact that whoever wrote this did the Elmer Fudd voice right. Like the way he talks, the way they spelled the words were like the way Elmer Fudd really talks. And
nice.
Daffy Duck would always go to his house and like steal food, take things from him. And he's like, "Man, I got to think of something to get Daffy Duck to just stop coming around." So he knew a friend that had another duck, a woman duck. And he's like, "Well, if I get him interested in the opposite sex and interested in something else, maybe he will not care about coming over here and leeching off of me all the time." And then, that didn't work out too well, because he brought the girl over and he wasn't interested in the girl at all. He was interested in all the stuff that he prepared for the meal and all that stuff. He had no interest in the girl until Elmer Fudd burned the dessert. And then the woman duck actually says, "Well, I can make a better dessert." And she makes the dessert and it's amazing. So Daffy Duck's now interested in the girl. And she said, She says, "Yeah, I learned to cook because my dad owns a restaurant." And Daffy Duck's eyes get bigger. He's like, "Restaurant?" You know, like, I love restaurants. So I'm like, I could go to the restaurant. And he falls in love with this girl just because of it's food driven. You know, he's like, "I'm going to use her to get food." But now he has to borrow like Elmer Fudd's car and his gas money and all this other stuff. So Elmer Fudd at the end of it is like, "Man, I really got burned because he's leeching off of me again." So it was pretty interesting. It was entertaining. I was very entertained.
Yeah, it sounds funny. It's funny that Daffy Duck is, he only cares about food.
Yeah.
And they would do those in the Looney Tunes cartoons, how they would try to bring a female in or to get them. You know, like Bugs Bunny would dress up as a woman or something like that.
Yeah.
They would try to use the sex appeal. Mm-hmm. That's funny. Well, my last one is I just have one more too, and I'm going back to DC on this one. I read the first issue of Hawkman, and I think it's Volume 2. It's the one that was right around Crisis on Infinite Earths. That followed.
Is it Tony Isabella?
Yeah.
Shadow of the Hawkman.
Yeah. Well, it's the series that followed after.
It's like 18 issues or something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Which I didn't read. Shadow War.
1987. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't read Shadow War of the Hawkman. Miniseries.
Yeah.
I did. Brian Reigate on Comics and History. He a while back did a. Did a Hawkman retrospective. And one of the episodes that he did during that was he did a complete overview of the Shadow War miniseries.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, so I had listened to that. And so I'd still like to read it at some point, but I had this issue, and it is kind of funny how it says first issue of the new adventures of Hawkman. So you have first and new, but then there's a little explosion bubble that says the shadow war continues.
Yeah.
So you have first and new, but continues, and that's kind of tells you something about the issue. But nonetheless, you can get into it. As you said, it was written by Tony Isabella, with art by Richard Howell, penciler, and Don Heck is the inker. Michelle Wolfman, colorist. And it's called Secrets. And it opens up, it actually kind of tells you a little bit, gives you at least, it doesn't spell it right out, but it gives you kind of a sense of what has been going on, because it introduces you to Herbert Lesser, who is the Thanagarian's agent on Earth, and how they've been using him, basically kind of through blackmail, with his computer abilities. They knew that he was stealing money, so through blackmail they've been kind of using him and their shadow war of conquering Earth. So then we go to Carter and Shiera, and they're at the museum, and Kator is he's looking at a newspaper that I presume goes back to the miniseries, talking about an event of alien killers attacking a museum and Mavis Trent being killed wearing a Hawk Woman costume. So they don't have any ability to track the Thanagarians, because they can't get their detector working properly. They can't get access to the parts they need on the planet Earth. And it seems they've been they had been cooperating with Gentleman Ghost in the past, and he hasn't been able to come up with any leads. He's been troubled by the arrival of Casta, who it tells us in a editor's note that that's the Thanagarian killer who attacks Superman in DC Comics Presents 95. Always a fan of editor's notes telling you what issue to go check out. Well, they are able to detect that there's a some sort of the way their detector works is they can't tell that a Thanagarian ship is approaching, and they only know once there's been a landing, and there's been a landing near the museum, only 6 blocks away, at the Midway City Justice Center. So they stood up as Hawkman and Hawkwoman. They have kind of a funny exchange, because they're flying away, and Hawkman has a like this long this axe head with a long staff, and Shiera has basically like a spear. She says, "Why such lethal looking weapons, Katar? You know we won't use them to kill." He says, "True enough, Shiera, but if you were your basic paranoid miscreant and you saw hawk-headed figures swooping at you with these in hand, would you bet the ranch we wouldn't use them?" She says, "I see what you mean." And then he says, "Besides, I like swinging these things around." To which she just responds, "Men." But I thought it was kind of funny.
Swinging it around.
Yeah. took the time to actually explain why they carry these weapons, but, you know, didn't like kill people with them. But they get to the Justice Center, and they're sort of ally. They're human, non-powered ally. Captain Frazier, fills them in, that they got kind of a jailbreak going on. In the city lockup, it's not a maximum security facility, but there's been stuff going on at the facility. So, they've got some prisoners there because the prisoners have trials currently taking place, and they've upped the security, but somehow the security is designed to keep people from escaping, but somehow someone has smuggled in artillery to these hard criminals that they're holding there, and they even sent a chopper in to take a look at what was going on. The chopper was shot out of the sky and destroyed. So Captain Fraser, he has a plan that he lets the Hawks in on, and they basically set up a smoke screen so that the Hawks can drop in and try to get a jump on them. But unfortunately, once they land on the top of the Justice Center, they hear a voice that they recognize, and it turns out to be the Shadow Thief, a villain that they're well familiar with. But they're surprised to see that that he seems to be holding a solid gun, which Hawkman's interested to see because he thinks, you know, if you're solid enough to hold a gun, then you must be solid enough for me to grab you. And he takes Shadow Thief by the hands and shakes him and knocks the gun loose. So Shadow Thief explains that he was trapped in the shadow dimension, and his powers have basically increased. He doesn't need the dimension meter that that he normally uses to control his powers, and he can control how dense he is now, just on his own will. Apparently, something happened in World's Finest issue 270. That's where it took place, that he was trapped. And he's even able to. He also has a Thanagarian distortion field that he uses, that he was hiding the prisoners in. So the prisoners all of a sudden appear, surround the Hawks, and they all have guns. They start firing, so they have to kind of retreat a little bit, but just far enough to sort of swing around and get a jump on, get the advantage, tactical advantage on the prisoners. And they start attacking and are able to take out all of the prisoners, but the Shadow Thief has used that as a distraction to get away. So while this is all going on, we check in again with Herbert Lesser, the Thanagarian's human agent, and tells us a little bit more about the different people that have been blackmailed or seduced into working for the invaders, and just how his life has kind of become pretty bad since he's been involved in this. So once again, Hank and Shira are back in their regular clothes and stuff, and these two blondes, a guy and a girl, show up, they were supposed to. These apparently Hank and Shira were supposed to meet up with them, Joe and Coral, had something to do with the museum work. And Joe's like super duper angry. I think that they might be like the board of directors or the board of trustees or something for the museum, and they're basically saying, you know, you guys aren't fit to run the museum. He doesn't know what it is that's causing it, but basically their work as Hawkman and Hawkwoman is interfering with their ability to run the museum, and he's tired of their excuses. And this woman, Coral, tells them, you know, I'll talk to, once Joe storms off. He's like, she says, I'll talk to him, you know, once he relaxes. But he's not been doing very well. And it seems that this Joe had been involved with the woman Mavis Trent, that we know has died, and he has been drinking again, ever since she passed. And he was in love with her, and he blames Hank and Chiara for their death. It seems that there was an attack on the museum that caused her death. Looks like shadow creatures had attacked the museum, and he thinks that Hank and Chiara allowed Hawkman and Hawkwoman to come in to the museum to fight the battle, and if they hadn't allowed Hawkman and Hawkwoman in, that Mavis wouldn't have been killed. Well, it turns out that they aren't aware that this Coral actually is. I'm not sure if she's either a Thanagarian herself or working for the Thanagarians. Well, Hank and Chiara, they're the only ones on Earth that whose minds can't be read by the Thanagarians Absorbiscan. See a little picture of some of the other heroes as they're thinking about them. So they're kind of going to use their detective skills to sort to try to track down the suspect. And so we sort of have a montage of sorts as they're as they fly around and use some like take some pictures, and they're even they we even see them underwater basically searching things out, you know, because they're at this point, the Hawks, they were police officers on Thanagar. Eventually they find a they look like they're in a wooded area, and they find this device, this piece of metal that looks like it says Hyathis Corp. They recognize the name Hyathis. Apparently, that's Hyathis is a creature who Shira says named after the creature who turned our people to strife and conquest, but she was overthrown. But Hank says, you know, I or Carter, I keep calling him Hank. I don't know why I'm doing that. Hank Hall, Carter Hall. I think that must be why. I'm mixing up my halls. Carter says that he had seen that name, that Hyathis Corp, and he thought it was a coincidence, but it was a mistake that his people are being clever. And sure enough, we see Herbert Lesser in his computers, and we see a meeting, including that woman Coral, who's apparently been signed to keep an eye on the Hawks. They're all sort of meeting. It seems that they're kind of the board of this Hyathis corporation, and that the Thanagarians are have a plot to control the next president of the United States, and through them control the government. The only, you know, the only people that can that figure out what's going on and stop them are Hawkman and Hawkwoman. But we see a news on the last page. We see a newspaper. The Midway Post must be that day's edition, and it says "Heroes exposed as aliens. Museum curators are Hawkman and Hawkwoman." So it seems like things are going to be more difficult for them because they're going to be outed. One final thing that's kind of neat, that they actually included a who's who page at the back of the issue for the Shadow Thief to tell you more about him and to tell you his history and stuff. I'm not sure if this is an original who's who page or if it's just a reprint from who's who. I can't I would assume Shadow Thief was probably included.
It's probably
So
from Who's Who, yeah.
Probably a reprint, yeah. But yeah, overall, I feel like I understand. It did make me wish I had read Shadow Thief or the Shadow War, even though I listened to Brian's episode. But at the same time, I felt like I could, even though it didn't like have like a straight up recap, I felt like I could gather a lot of stuff from context to read Hawkman. You know, like I kind of feel like you can go back, and I remember for a while on several episodes you were covering issues of Volume 3 of Hawkman. I feel like you can go back and read other Hawkman stories if you just take them at face value and don't try to like synthesize everything.
Yeah.
All the different versions. Like you can kind of, you might hesitate to do so because you hear that it's confusing, but it's if you try to tie everything together, like you can just go back and read a volume and just take it as that version of Hawkman.
And you can see how like Geoff Johns linked all of it too.
Yeah. And if
like
you go
he took different time periods and took pieces of it and made his own.
Yeah. And if you do know, it's neat to kind of read the Hawkman, Geoff Johns volume. I think that would be Volume 4. And see how he ties everything together. And you could do it that way and read Geoff Johns and then go back and that would kind of help you piece it together. But even if you don't, you know, you can kind of just, they stand on their own. It's just when you try to fit everything into continuity that it gets confusing. So I enjoyed it. Be cool to see another Hawk. I know the Hawkman series that they did for the New 52 didn't really succeed, but we're going to get a mini series and I'm looking forward to that of Hawkman, Adam Strange.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I know miniseries typically don't sell well, but I'm looking forward to seeing some Hawkman, see if maybe they can kind of, the way they've been doing with a lot of the other Rebirth stuff, like put a little bit more of the original flavor in there and to appeal to people.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that was it for me.
All right. That's it for me, too. So you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com and also on the Facebook page is a Geek Brunch Podcast, at MythMakingETC on Twitter, at Mike Myers Brunch, and Mike at comicbooknoise.com and MythMakingETC at gmail.com, so you can send us email and we'll reply to it and also probably mention it on the show as well. If you get a chance, leave an iTunes review, we'd really appreciate it. And Any podcasts you want to plug that are coming up for you, Chris?
It might come out before this, but the second, Rob and I just recorded the second episode of Comic Book Booster Club. So if you haven't checked that out yet, we're doing that monthly and we tend to talk about more newer titles. So that's something that is out there, something fairly new to check out. I guess that's about it.
And by the time you listen to this, you'll probably have, me and Daryl started recording another podcast where we talk about all the Rebirth titles. And what spawned this off is we were on Rebirthically, and then we were like, we really like to talk about what we read during the week. And we IM each other anyway. So why not record it? What we try to do is keep it to an hour, and it turned into like 2.5 hours.
Of course.
of course, because we had a long discussion about pretty much every issue. But I got that coming up. So that'll be on the DC Noise feed. It's called DC Weekly Reads. And that one's going to be an interesting one because we're releasing it on DC Noise as well as the Taylor Network. So it should have a more broad audience for sure.
Because you guys, didn't you do something like that before so that you could actually talk about DC Comics?
Yeah, we started this thing called DC Spotlight, but it didn't last long. And now that we're reading all of them pretty much the week that they come out, we decided to do this. Even though it's called weekly, we don't know if it's going to be weekly because we're not going to record that plus DC Noise the same. So, like, if we record DC Noise with Keith, we're not going to record this one.
Gotcha.
It's just like a replacement for whenever we don't record DC noise. And we also have, we have times on Saturday nights where we're actually doing stuff, and we'll take those weeks sure. off too. So
yeah, we talk, Rob and I right now are both reading everything as well. So on our first episode, we talked about a lot of Rebirth stuff on this next episode, we just kind of touched briefly on the titles that had launched since the last time we talked. So the newer ones that had come out since we had last talked. We talked a little bit more in detail about Hellblazer.
I find now that I know his secret, I find it really strange. My mind can't grasp
alphabetically.
My mind can't grasp doing that like at all. Like for in terms of mood, because I'm a mood reader, but I guess he's not a mood reader. He's a chronological alphabetical reader.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like
everybody
he does that
has their own, but I think if I did that, it would affect my enjoyment. Like I already find, truthfully, that doing the weekly, you know, like how I'm doing this weekly thing now, it does affect my enjoyment a little bit, because it's more like I'm going to read it all the week it comes out, and instead of like three issues back to back to back when I'm in the total mood for it. Right. So what I end up trying to do with the weekly stuff is I try to read it in an order that I'm in the mood for. So like if it's towards the end of the night and I want something light and funny, I'll read Harlequin. You know what I mean? And if I want something like a little deeper, I'll read in the morning when I'm more alert.
Yeah.
When I'm more in the mood for it. And then I just kind of go like, am I in the mood for Superman, Batman, or something magic, or you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, because you're very much a mood reader. My guess is eventually, even with Rebirth, you'll get to a point where you don't keep up with it.
Yeah, it'll
just because you're so much.
I will buy it all. That will never stop.
Oh, that won't change. I know that too.
I don't know how long the power reading through it all will last. I'd like it to keep up, but I know it's going to increase, especially with Young Animal and everything else that's coming out.
Yeah.
Because right now 11 books isn't bad, you know, reading between Wednesday and Saturday, but that 11 books is going to become 22 in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, it keeps increasing. I mean, because I even know like my shipment of the books that came out in June, all the Rebirth stuff, it was a pretty small pile. And then you added a bunch of titles in July. And so the pile is definitely bigger, the July books. And then there's some new titles that came out this month, and there's some new ones that are coming out in September. So it'll keep getting bigger. But I mean, I remember with the New 52 when New 52 started, you were kind of current for a while, and then that eventually changed.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But yeah, it is interesting how Rob, I don't think he doesn't do this with back issues, which he'll just kind of throw in, but his new, he gets DCBS bi-weekly.
Yeah.
So he'll take his shipment, he'll divide it up into the 2 weeks that the comics came out on. And then he'll take that pile and alphabetize it. And so then he reads the 1 week alphabetically, and then he reads the second week alphabetically. And it's funny because now that I know that I can see where he's at.
Well, it's good to understand a reading pattern too, because I think that has to affect his enjoyment too. It has to.
Maybe.
It has to. You can't. In my mind, you can't read like. You can't read something in order like that alphabetically and totally be in the mood for that. It just, how could you do that? But I guess you can. Maybe just because I can't understand it, it's hard for me to see how you could.
Yeah, you're kind of on opposite extremes.
And then I'm like, I have that collector mentality about ordering. Mm-hmm. And he posted on there that like if it had a numerical number in it that he reads it, that drives me insane, like personally, because numerics come before alphabet, in terms of cataloging and everything. Like if they have like a number on the cover that says like the number four, I will categorize it. I'll open the inside cover, and if it has the number four, it'll be catalog before it gets into the alphabet. But if it's called like four, like FOUR, I will categorize it in the F's. And that's even the way the databases work. You know, like just the way database search engines work, database works. So I find it very interesting that he would put in that. And that's how I categorize companies too. Even though I understand why previews went away from that, because what was happening was previews was getting all these companies coming out with numerics in to get into the front of previews. Because their thought was, if I get a numeric number, I'm going to be in the front and I'd have a better chance of selling more issues if they see me first versus when they see me down the line. Well, they caught on to that. They caught on to that strategy and they were like, well, I'm going to do it by alphabetical because people are taking advantage of the system and they know that we're doing it alphabetically. And they're putting numbers in the title of their company so they can get it in the front of previews. So I can understand their logic on switching it, but it originally started out as being alphabetically, and then people caught on to it and said, well, I'd rather be in the front than the back. But like 451 Media and 259, whatever, all those publishing, like when I sort indies, they're by company alphabetically. So like 451 will be before A's, you know? But that's just the way we all have our quirks, that's for sure.
No, I'm the same way with you with numbers, 'cause that goes into like library cataloging and stuff.
And that's like even when it goes back into like when you're a student in the library and back when we didn't have computers and you'd use the library cards, you'd do that too. To find what you wanted, you'd open up these little drawers and find out on the paper index what how to find your book.
We have all of our quirks. I mean, when it comes to reading, I'm kind of in between you guys. Like I like organization, and so sometimes I'll use alphabetizing to help me if I can't decide what to read. If I want to, though, I'll break out of it. I won't stay chained to it if I'm like.
You won't force yourself to read something because you have it if you're not in the mood for it.
So I'm kind of in between you guys.
Yeah, I find it fascinating because like even when I do that Mike M's Collectors, just asking questions because we're all so different.
Yeah,
We
definitely.
all have our like things, right?
Yeah, I like hearing
So
how
it's
people do
like
stuff.
it is very interesting, like the way Bob Bretall categorizes makes so much sense for a world record holder and being able to maintain and track your books. But
Yeah, his
where it
size.
drives me absolutely batshit crazy is he never does a merge. And what that does is it makes it hard to like if you want to reread it, like because then you have to say, okay, where's number two? Oh, it's in box 13. Oh, where's that? Oh, it's in the garage. Okay, now where's box 27? Box 27 is in my room here in the closet. Now I can find issue two. But from a cataloging, like knowing where everything is, it makes like total sense. And one of the hardest things about having a large collection is the merge. It's like the worst thing ever. That's something I don't enjoy at all. But I feel the need to. I don't know. It's like a compulsion. Every time I go to the basement, I'll try to merge like two boxes just to for my own thing. We have our own quirks. I'd rather know like where they are, and I want them to be together where they belong.
Yeah. Well, I guess you have your retirement project figured out.
Yeah, it'll be fun but painful because I'll be that much older. And pulling out boxes and lifting them and stuff like that isn't that fun.
That's when you have to call your nephew. You're
Yeah.
like, get over here.
Yeah, you're gonna do well. That's what I want to hire you for. Come down and I just couldn't pay your salary.
Well, that's why, yeah, I was trying to be. I mean, I
And
was going
give
to
you
volunteer
medical
again, but
benefits.
if I lived in the area, I probably would just do it because I like organizing and I like looking at comics. So if I lived near you, I'd probably just come over and tell you, buy me a dinner or something.
That's right. Come work
So,
for a couple hours and do these boxes.
yeah. All right. Well,
All
until
right. And we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Yep.
I'll be in Baltimore in a couple weeks, so we'll skip
Is
that
that
week.
how it falls? Okay.
Yeah. So we'll be the following week. So,
All right. Sounds good.
all right. Talk to you
All
later, and
right.
you have a
Sounds
good whatever's left of the weekend. See ya.
Yeah, you too. All
Bye.
right. Bye-bye.